The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, is being slim, youthful and wrinkle-free now a moral responsibility?
If I'd grown up in China, I'd walk like a Chinese girl and I'd gesticulate like a Chinese girl and my maxillofacial muscles would operate like a Chinese person. So my face would look very different, even though it's got this kind of physiognomy. There's the most extraordinary compression, if you like, or collapse of cultural difference.
From breast enlargements to leg extensions, we talk bodies with Susie Orbach. Plus, this should jog your memory. We visit a memory-making exhibition. And it's a dream come true for most men, a device that lets them take over a woman's body.
You could put yourself into the body of a very large person or a very thin person. You might put your mind into the body of a minority and know what that would be like in a virtual environment where you were a complete minority.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. In the studio today are the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, and the Guardian's science guru, Ian Sample, not as drunk or tired as last week, I'm hoping, Ian?
No, I was sober. I was just exhausted after the election.
Are you pleased with the election results, both of you, since we're going to talk about it a bit later? Robin?
Not particularly, no.
No?
No.
So as a Labour supporter, yep, this is time for a regeneration and renewal.
Well, that's what I'm going to hope for. I'm taking the best hope for that. Yes, exactly. Regeneration.
Ian, how about you?
I think pleased is the wrong word. Interested, no doubt. Yeah, I think it's really going to be fun to see what happens, even if it may be a bit of a car crash.
Well, we'll talk a bit about that later. Also here is psychotherapist Susie Orbach. She's the author of a 1978 bestseller, Fat is a Feminist Issue. And she's also a former columnist at The Guardian. Her new book is called Bodies. It charts the countless ways we've now got to make big changes to our bodies. Everything from bulking up with steroids to Botoxing your eyebrows, having a facelift to getting a boob job. It's all part of the pressure to look flawless. And yet, says Susie, we still seem unhappy with these modified bodies of ours. Susie, welcome.
Hello.
So let's start right from the beginning. This book is about how we can change bodies and how it's affecting essentially our minds. Just paint us a picture, though, of what kinds of things people are doing to themselves.
Right from the beginning, baby pictures these days are being retouched so that you get a baby with the dimple that you wanted in it. And maybe somebody's buying that baby a soft high heel so that it's already practicing and mimicking, this is a girl, what is in store for her in terms of femininities. And I don't think there's any picture, maybe at The Guardian it's very different, but certainly in a glossy, there's no picture that's in a magazine that isn't back and forth between the art director and the retouchers 200 times, so that most of the visual images we see are entirely constructed. And it's having a huge impact on all of our bodies, particularly younger people's. And it's really what I've been trying to write about in Bodies is, what are bodies for today? Because in this post-industrial world, we seem not really to know what to do with them. And so we're in the process, really, instead of using our bodies to manufacture things and to make things, we're actually manufacturing a body and creating it in a particular image, which we're then exporting all over the world and, in a way, taking away the bodies that exist. I mean, in helping Chinese people insert a 10 centimeter rod into their legs or fix all those noses that aren't considered sufficiently westernized under the hijab, or turning Fijian girls into bulimics, what we're saying is that there's an international brand called this kind of body. And in a way, body types are disappearing as fast as languages. So the book isn't just about the horrors. It's also trying to theorize how we get a body and what we're up to with our bodies today.
You also talk about how we're using our bodies to show what we've achieved. So in the past, a worker on a building site might have had a very muscly body, but now you show that through, that's a representation of going to the gym, because we don't necessarily lift, you know, weights to build buildings anymore. At least I don't know about you, Ian. But it's a sense of, and clothes and makeup and all those sorts of modifications are essentially cultural transmission to some extent.
Yeah, I think bodies are always been, our sense of our body is always culturally constructed. There is no such thing as a body outside of culture, right? And we learn about our bodies in the culture that we grow up in. So today, you're absolutely right. Guys will go to the gym and they'll create the kind of body that shows that they are working on their body, that they have the strength. They may be brain workers, but they have the strength for the guys who used to work on the roads or on the buildings. But there's something more complicated in terms of the cultural construction of bodies, because we do have very different kinds of bodies. If I'd grown up in China, I'd walk like a Chinese girl and I'd gesticulate like a Chinese girl, and my maxillofacial muscles would operate like a Chinese person. So my face would look very different, even though it's got this kind of physiognomy. So we're now modifying all of that because English is becoming a language that's everywhere. Cultures that bite instead of kiss are kind of learning that isn't the right thing to do. There's the most extraordinary compression, if you like, or collapse of cultural difference.
Robin, Ian, let me bring you both in, actually. There's one thing that occurred to me whilst reading this book was that a lot of the cosmetic procedures, the surgery that Susie talks about, that is becoming more available to people if you have the money, these are results of advances in medical science and, at some level, and as medical science improves, if you want to talk about replacement parts, stem cell research and things in 20 years, I mean, you could grow your own nose, you could grow all sorts of things that are perfect. But do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, the thing is, with any scientific advance, it's neutral. And it's what society chooses to use it for. I mean, atomic power was used both for peaceful purposes and for military purposes. So it's not the technology's fault. It's led. And yes, we already had something like the ability to make human growth hormone in the laboratory was of great use. But then it's given to people who are 5 foot. I've given these injections daily so they could grow, a maximum of 1 inch, maybe 2 inches in life. Then it becomes very, I would have thought, morally questionable to do these kind of things. So,
and the same with steroids or other drugs which are initially created for a particular condition used by so-called healthy people to improve their own abilities.
I mean, one of the things that I found really interesting in looking at the modern cosmetic surgery is how much it comes out of the burns treatment in the Second World War.
Oh, right.
When very high temperature burns from aircraft had to be treated because you needed to patch up the airmen. And there was an extraordinary hospital and surgeon who learned an awful lot about what to do and treated the guys who'd been burnt in a very humane way and then displayed them at London premiere so that the disability that had come through their disfiguring was actually turned round into a celebration of who they were. But actually that piece of technology then came into the development of cosmetic surgery.
Ian?
Can I just be clear, Susie? Are you saying there's a problem with either extremes of body modification, or is it the kind of the poor body image that you think is problematic, or do you not have a problem with either? And if you do, how are you making this moral? Where's the moral line?
Well, I suppose to answer that, I suppose I've been trying to ask, as a psychoanalyst and a social commentator, why are we seeing this massive rise in extreme body modifications? What the hell is that about? And I've been practicing for a long time, and people used to come in with body difficulties and be upset about them, a small group of people. And nowadays, everybody comes, whether they are talking about a bereavement or the loss of a job or a struggle with a child, and they say, en passant, of course, I hate my body and wish I could change it. Now, that cultural change, that sort of cultural dysmorphia that we've got needs answering. And it seems to me that it's the impact the commercialization of the beauty culture and style culture that is creating this fantastic body distress in complex ways. I mean, I'm a psychoanalyst, so I wouldn't just say it's because of all the ads and all the visual culture. It's how that then enters into the culture of the family and how that affects the mother who's bringing up the baby, etc. So I think these two things are related. I don't think they're separate at all.
Women, I presume, are more pressured into this. Do you think it's... presumably there is changes coming for men as well.
Well, of course there are changes. You look at men's health magazines, they're exactly like Cosmopolitan 20 years ago. It's such a huge market. If you look at economic growth, even during this time of almost flatness, you get the cosmetic and really successful cosmetic companies have got a 14% growth rate. I mean, most of them got a 7 or 8% growth rate. Well, of course they want the men, and of course they're capturing the men, and there are men's cosmetics. The Guardian's had ads for them on it on its page 3, actually, huge ads for L'Oreal men's products. And a lot of the cosmetic surgery procedures are marketed to men, as are, if you look at the fashions now, they're marketed in a different kind of way, which involve undoing the kind of forms of masculinity that have been around. So now you see the mannequins, the male mannequins with 27-inch waists and looking very wan and kind of heroin chic, if you like. So the same sort of undermining of the diversity of masculinities is what's happening for men. And it's certainly happening for younger men. I think, you know, probably if you're over 45, 50, you're just about okay.
Do you think that this is going to... I mean, you've just hinted at what's in store for men, but do you think it's going to get worse? Is it going to get more into a situation for men and women who are young to do more cosmetic surgery, to do take more drugs that become thin?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no line.
You talk to 6- and 7-year-old kids, and what's horrifying to me, this is where the moral bit comes in, is that they already know how to Photoshop themselves. And they already think that they will do it in real terms, i.e. cosmetic surgery has been normalized for that generation. So by the time they're 12, 13, they've already agitated for the breasts or whatever it is. And I think there is going to be... I mean, it's just a very, very...
13-year-olds who want... breast enlargements.
Oh, absolutely. There are 11-year-olds who won't go to school without full makeup. I mean, we're talking about major public health emergency, which usually shows up in the so-called obesity stats, but actually is much more prevalent across the whole population, having destabilized bodies.
Well, obesity is interesting because we have rising rates of obesity and an increasing obsession with becoming thin.
I think those two are entirely related. I think the minute you introduce thinness, and that happened in my youth around Twiggy, you create something about the body body differences not being okay. And my whole youthful group, we all dieted. And now that group of mothers, I mean, you know, thank God I got beyond that, but it became a way of trying to transform your body. And of course, one of the impacts of continual dieting is that you gain weight. It is the absolute best way to gain weight. You know, diets have a 97% recidivism rate. If you go on diets continually, you mess up your metabolism and you slow down the set point that regulates your weight, and you get bigger and bigger and bigger, and you make a lot of fat for the diet companies. I mean, they actually depend upon repeat customers, but you also change the whole way your body relates. So there's a direct relationship between an aesthetic of thinness and the so-called obesity stats. But I mean, if you're going to get into the obesity stats, I must say that they are completely erroneous. I mean, even on the National Institutes of Health's reanalysis of them, you know, it isn't the case that they're as terrible as they look. And if you want to put George Clooney in the obese category, you can. But frankly, I wouldn't. And that kind of figure is in the obesity stats because they've got this bizarre measure called the BMI, which is probably one of the most stupid statistical whimsies that's ever been created. And it was created or promoted by the pharmaceutical companies and the slimming companies who designed stuff for the international obesity.
And that's being used by international health authorities.
Correct. Yeah. And even Michelle Obama, I see, who I would have thought was a smart woman, has come into pushing this in her obesity task force.
Are there particular procedures, cosmetic procedures perhaps, which you think I just would rather see the back of it? Because you can kind of see the point of some.
I'd understand the pressure that people experience and why they come to feel that they need to transform themselves.
But are there some things, you talked about the extensions of legs before, which seems completely unnecessary to me, but I don't understand why those people would want that. I mean,
I think the reason that's happening is because modernity can be measured in global terms by sort of your entry into taking up a westernized body. I mean, in Scandinavia, they've had a leg shortening procedure for the last 20 years. So, look, it's not my job to say these things should be banned. I think what I'm trying to say is, take this seriously, folks. This is not trivial. This is a very, very serious kind of issue that people are involved in the transformation of their bodies. This isn't just a little issue or a woman's issue. This is something that is engaging people at a very deep level, and we really need to think about the commercial pressures that are behind it and how they get inside of us.
One of the procedures you talk about in your book is a labiaplasty. Now, I can't see myself. What would drive someone to do something like that?
Well, I think, first of all, you need to create a situation in which girls and women are uptight about their sexuality, which we can do pretty well in this culture because we've got a highly over-sexualized culture without any real understanding of kind of the erotics, I think. You have education programs in school that show girls how to put on condoms, but actually don't tell them anything about their clitoris or their vaginas or show the variety of what they look like. So you can see how a girl could become insecure about it and could then be drawn, given how strong visual culture is, to, do I look all right there? I mean, you have programs on telly saying, you know, do you have a weird labia? And then you go on to, there is just punch in labiaplasty into the internet, and there are gynecologists, obstetricians, plastic surgeons who do labiaplasties. You can look at pictures of perfectly normal labias, which they have described as being extremely odd, and that they will then give you a labia that looks like a Brazilian wax gone tucked, with everything else tucked in. And you can see how that happens, and it's a big growing operation.
Okay, well, we'll leave that there for now. Susie's book Bodies is out now. Join our Facebook group if you want to talk about some of this stuff, or you can leave a message on our blog too at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. We told you last week of a super secret event that we're planning. And now we can reveal nearly everything about it. It's the first ever recording of this podcast in front of a live studio audience. Intense negotiations are still taking place, but the venue has been finalised. It's the home of science itself, London's Science Museum. Our recording will be part of the Lates event on Wednesday the 26th of May. Of course, we want you to be there to ask questions, wolf whistle Ian Sample, and generally get involved. If you get bored of us, then you'll love the rest of the night too. The theme of the Science Museum event is genius. The museum have some truly top names already signed up to talk on the night. Albert Einstein is pretty much the only person who won't be there. There's comedy, a pub quiz, and even a silent disco. For more details of the night and other adult-only events, click on the link on our blog or go to sciencemuseum.org.uk/lates. And just remember to put this date in your diary, 6:45 till 10 p.m. on Wednesday the 26th of May. It's even free to get in. More details to follow, including who our special guest will be.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
An exhibition which attempts to jog your memories opening this week in London. Called Pattern Completion, it explores flashbacks and the subconscious. Producer Andy went to find out more.
My name's Michaela Natal. I'm an artist and I work with film and video and animation. If you walk into the gallery, the first thing you'll see is a cluster of four glass spheres that are suspended in the gallery space. Behind them is a video projector projecting imagery of forests. We're trying to describe certain spaces that might be evocative to many people and bring back memories of times when they'd been in forests or woodlands in the past.
My name's Tom Simmons. I'm a sound designer. I work at Norwich University College of the Arts, where I teach and do research there. My role in this project has been to explore the sonic aspect of the installation and this part of the memory process. The headphones contain, well, of course, the sound part of the installation, and that's a series of very filtered binaural sound recordings which make correspondences to the images that appear in the glass spheres. So they describe very similar parts of the topography of the woodland and work as cues to bring back sounds and images into our listening space, our consciousness. First, it might be useful for us to play back one of the original sound recordings. So this is an original binaural sound recording that's made up in some very old woodland in Yorkshire. And if you have headphones on, you should be able to hear some of the spatial information that's captured about the forest in the sound recording.
We decided, rather than using live-action film or video, that we would use a particular technique of time-lapse photography. With conventional time-lapse, those photographs would be played back one after the other, sort of straight, so that the time seems to be accelerated. But in this case, we wanted to create quite a sort of dreamlike and an otherworldly feeling, and we wanted to sort of expand time in a sense, so the time and the space feels sort of slightly unusual and perhaps a bit like the sort of space and time that you recreate when you're remembering a past event.
When a member of the audience is standing looking at these four glass spheres and an image comes into the sphere that's really on the left-hand side, a sound should appear in a cone, a sound cone inside our listening space, which is really located very closely to the left-hand portion of our hearing field.
I'm Hugo Spears. I'm a neuroscientist at University College London. My research focuses on memory and how we navigate space. And one of the challenges of being a scientist is trying to creatively think about the research questions about how processes work, and for me, about how memory and the brain operate. The interest here has been on that process by which you actually bring back, when you travel back in time in your mind, when you remember the past, and you pull back all these fragments of things that happened to you, remembering where you were, who was there, what sounds you heard. And scientists for a long time have been developing mathematical models of how memory might work in terms of the network of brain cells in certain regions of your brain, particularly the hippocampus, a small curled up structure deep inside your head that seems to be critical for memory. So scientists think that within this structure, the networks of cells lay down traces within the connections between the billions and thousands of neurons there as you go about your daily life. But if you want to recall a memory, you need to reactivate a set of connections in these cells. This occurs via a process called pattern completion. So, for example, if you're trying to remember what somebody said at a party, you might have the person's name, and from that fragment, you're trying to reconstitute the experience of that party and what they were saying. And the idea is that the network reverberates with this information, starts off in a certain state of activity, but slowly and iteratively the network moves and moves and changes its state until it resolves and refills in a pattern of activity that was there when you were actually at the party. By simulating the networks that we're playing within this installation, scientists have tried to find estimates of how many events, in theory, given the number of cells and the number of connections in these networks inside the brain, how many memories could you, in theory, hold? But those questions are very, you know, trying to actually find the precise number is a bit of a dark art, and there's so many factors that would influence how effective the network would be that it's probably not an easy question to answer. Well, our memories are not a perfect reconstruction of the past. We do not have a videotape rolling inside our head that replays that. They are riddled with errors. But they're not completely error-prone, and we do, you know, if we couldn't remember the past, we would fail in our everyday life, and indeed, that's what happens in severe dementia and amnesia. But the, you know, the processes we're playing with this installation exactly mimic some of these problems we have, particularly interference. So when you're trying to remember, when you're trying to, in this installation, imagine going back to a forest, an adventure you had in a forest, you might have the wrong bit of forest in part of your memory and go, wait, you know, you might realize that doesn't work, that stream wasn't there. And so we do a lot of monitoring of our memories, and we take it for granted, but we're often checking, self-checking our memories. And indeed, that can go wrong in certain types of clinical cases where people can't monitor their memories. And for them, it's, you know, they're full of interfering facts that jumble their memories around.
The Pattern Completion Exhibition runs from the 20th to the 22nd of May at London's Gimpel Fees Gallery. More details at pattern-completion.net.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
If you follow this podcast on Twitter, we are at Science Weekly, and we'll let you know whenever a new podcast is launched there. Also, for all of the rest of the Guardian Science content, just follow Guardian Science. Now, let's have a look at some of the other stories around this week.
News Jack.
Britain has a new science minister, and he has the nickname Two Brains. Like all sectors of the government, the Conservative MP David Willetts will already be under pressure to make cuts to help reduce the public deficit. The new Conservative Lib Dem government has overlooked the man who had been Tory science spokesman, Adam Affrier.
Men's minds have been transferred into women's bodies, but only via virtual reality. Researchers projected men's sense of self into a non-existent woman, which changed the way they behaved and thought. And yes, when they looked down through their special goggles, they could even see their new body and clothes. The research is expected to shed light on the thorny neuroscientific puzzle of how our brain tells the difference between a part of our own body and something else in the wider world.
Marrying a younger man increases a woman's mortality rate. Females who are 7 to 9 years older than their husbands have a 20% greater chance of dying than if they were the same age. The findings are drawn from the medical records of 2 million Danish couples. Health records have shown previously that men live longer if they have a younger wife.
And a mother's phone call is as comforting as a hug. A oxytocin study suggests hearing her voice has the same stress-busting effect as an arm around the shoulder. Those behind the research are now looking at other forms of communication, such as text messaging, and expanding the study into animals.
So let's discuss some of those stories a bit. Ian Robin, the new science minister, David Willetts, Two Brains, nicknamed by our own very own Michael White, former political editor of The Guardian. He's really clever. What's the sort of score with her, how the scientific community have reacted to this?
With interest, I mean, yes, he's known as Two Brains. I think it's part of his body image because he's bald. You see, if he had his hair, he wouldn't have been called Two Brains. So he does look a bit celebrity. Yeah, I think it's the boldest remark, that's what I'm saying. He's, interestingly, his first forays into politics was as a researcher for Nigel Lawson. Now, Mr. Lord Lawson, climate change denier. It'd be interesting to see what kind of habits he's picked up from his first lord and master. He's going to be introduced to the science community later on this week. And it'll be interesting what he says on this subject. I imagine you'll get a very good grilling on that one. He is also chairman of a biosensor company, so there is some kind of technological interest in him. But by and large, his interests are very political and very economic in the past, so we wait and see.
He's responsible for science and universities, two areas which, as we hinted at in the last few weeks, discussing the different parties' science policies, two areas which are probably going to be hit quite hard when it comes to science, money cuts. Is he the kind of guy who's going to stand up for scientists like Drayson might have done, Paul Drayson, the former science minister?
I think that's just absolutely the key question that everyone is now just crossing their fingers for in the science community, and I don't think anyone really knows. I think some of the comments out there have been from within government that essentially the science community could not have got a better man than David Willetts.
It was all depressing last week, wasn't it, for science, given that there's only 70-odd ministers with science-ish backgrounds and Evan Harris wasn't elected.
Yeah. And plenty of people were worried that the former science shadow spokesman, Adam Afrier, was going to get it, actually, because he's spoken very, you know, perhaps just very honestly in the Evening Standard about how there will absolutely be cuts to the science budget. I think that probably is true. I think, you know, Willetts will probably have to see those through, or there may be some sort of freeze on funding, but, you know, essentially that would be a decline. But it's all really just a cross fingers and hope at the moment. I mean,
but it's not as bad as it could have been. I mean,
no, we could have ended up with a real dead duck, and I think he's going to be exciting. But I think you have to do well to beat Drayson, actually.
Okay, let's move on to the next story. This is a story about how virtual reality was used to transfer a man's mind into a woman's body. Ian, this has got to be one of your stories.
No, absolutely. But let's get one thing straight from the start. This wasn't done not done primarily to see what it was like for men to be inside a woman's body, if you want to use that. We're talking about virtual reality here, so let's get that straight as well. What it was all about was there is this neuroscience question about how does our mind define self in terms of what is a part of us and what is a part of the rest of the world. How does my brain know that this hand is mine and not, you know, not your hand? And so this study was really looking at, if you put someone in an immersive environment where when they look around, they see a female body, how much do they really feel as if they occupy that body? So, okay, you could use this to look at the neuroscience of how the mind sort of knows where the body is. But there's some interesting apps in this, some hugely interesting applications in this. And one of them could be just an enlightening thing. I mean, they're talking about you could put yourself into the body of, funnily enough, a very, very large person or very thin person, and you could get to know what that might feel like. You might put your body into, or your mind into, the body of a minority and know what that would be like in a virtual environment where you were a complete minority.
Would you really know what it's like to be a minority or a fat person or a thin person if you didn't really have the sort of physicality of it, I guess? Susie, what do you make of research like this? I mean, this must be helpful in terms of the basic neuroscience, perhaps.
Well, I think the neuroscience question about how you know which bit of your body is, whether it's your body or somebody else's body, is interesting. But I don't think the way you've taken it is interesting, if you don't mind my saying so, because I think the whole experience of fatness or being white or being gendered is better understood in cultural terms and is better understood by descriptions of people, and that's what we have literature for, and I don't think those or you can watch a movie like What Do Women Want, which I think is rather cute, where you have a man inside a learning the lines
the
of a woman.
We've had Mel Gibson overpower some sort of bit of scientific research in this podcast.
No, but exactly. The thing that interests me about this is that one of the things that I experience with my patients is that they don't really know where their bodies are. So they don't actually, they may have a physical sense of their bodies, but their forms of embodiment, their actual knowledge about it, is quite problematic. And I did go to the neuroscientist to try to understand this, and I have understood that actually, in a way, we all have phantom bodies. I mean, that's what Jonathan Miller would say, or Dan Glaser would say, that actually we do, that the body itself is a very complicated construction, and the fact is we've got all the bits we're supposed to, but the whole thing is phantomized in the brain. So I think these are interesting questions, but I'm not sure this is the way to go about them.
Well, one interesting thing I think it'd be nice to know if Susie has an idea on this is that if you spend an awful lot of time doing this kind of thing, and sound like a Luddite, I don't mean it that way, is can you spend so much time out of your own body that things become problematic when you turn this machine off after being on it for 8 weeks at a time, 8 hours a day? Does your sense of self return, and is it changed in any interesting way afterwards? It's all good fun stuff, I think.
Well, I think that's interesting because we do know that people are addicted to email relationships or fantasy relationships on the web, and that they can spend their whole life there, and that there is terrible withdrawal when those relationships go wrong and people don't have a way to return to themselves because they've experienced massive bereavement but have no way to kind of process what the hell's going on. You're talking about something many steps on from that. And so I would expect us it to change what we understand as being human. I don't think it won't modify us. I think it very seriously will.
Well, if you've got any thoughts on that issue, then you can write them on guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And for all the other science news this week, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Well, that's it for today. Thanks, as always, to Ian Sample and Robin McKee. Thanks also to Susie Orbach. Her book, Bodies, is out now. Don't forget to add your thoughts to whatever's been going on in science land at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Oh, and remember to put the special date in your diary. That's the live recording of Science Weekly at London Science Museum on Wednesday, the 26th of May. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.